Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an Elvis fan. She's at Graceland, and we'll hear how fans around the world are commemorating the anniversary of the King's death. That's today.
But first, we're getting another perspective on the Affordable Health Care Act. Yesterday, we talked to Senator Ron Johnson about the potential for a government shutdown to defund the new health care law. He said he doesn't think a government shutdown is a good idea, but Republicans should do everything they can to prevent this new law from being implemented.
Today, we're getting a different perspective on the Affordable Care Act. Robert Craig joins us. He's Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Now, some Republicans in Congress, not Senator Johnson, who was with us yesterday, are saying we need a government shutdown. We need to do some brinksmanship in the federal budget to delay implementation of the Affordable Care Act. How do you react to those calls?
Well, I think it's very counterproductive to have the debate of 4 years ago over and over again. Most of the public knows the current healthcare system is broken and is rampant with discrimination and wants us to move forward. Even if they're uncertain about the Affordable Care Act, they want us to move forward and try to make it work. And so I think it will really cause a backlash against conservatives if they shut down the government over something that's been the law for 4 years and has already been found constitutional by the Supreme Court.
Well, Senator Johnson seems certain about what's happening with implementation. He says it's going to be a train wreck. We're going to see premiums go up for people around Wisconsin. People are going to be knocked off their plans, a bureaucratic nightmare. Are you worried about implementation?
Well, I think it's a major challenge. We're doing something very, very broad, and it's more complicated because we decided to leave the current system in place and try to create a new system alongside that serves all the people who don't do well right now, people with pre-existing conditions, people uninsured, small businesses that can't afford health insurance. So there are going to be bumps in the road, but overall, there's no going back. We have a system now that has allowed discrimination against people just because they have a pre-existing condition, that is pricing most small businesses out of the health insurance market and leaving them at a huge competitive disadvantage, and doesn't create a situation where everyone has a guaranteed place to go to get affordable coverage no matter what, which is a necessity in modern life. And so we have to move forward, and I think it's a huge step forward, but we have to work together to make it work. And this attempt to sabotage it every step of the way makes it that much harder.
Well, are some of us, do you think, going to see premiums go up, though, as this thing comes into place?
Well, there's been a lot of attempts to make that claim, but it's been based on very misleading information. For example, it doesn't take into account the large premium tax credits. So a lot of states have announced their rates, they've been lower. In Wisconsin, the rates haven't come out yet. There'll be some people, like very young people who are healthy, who might pay a higher rate, but it's going to be much lower rates for women, for older people, with people with pre-existing conditions, for example. And it creates a situation where we don't base insurance on discrimination, on only insuring people who are a good risk to the insurance companies. And so the value is much higher. You get an insurance plan that no one can take away from you and which has guaranteed standards, has good coverage. And so we think the value is much higher. And in fact, according to the national experts, the average rate in Wisconsin, when you take into account the tax subsidies, will be less than now, even though we're covering a lot of people who are discriminated against and denied coverage today.
Some provisions of the law have been delayed by the White House, by President Obama. Critics are saying, hey, look, they keep pushing it back. That's a sign that this thing is not ready for prime time. What do you think about some of those delays we're seeing?
There are a lot of moving parts in this law, and so it was predictable that some things might not be ready. I think that some of those decisions were mistakes. And we should have gone forward. But overall, the meat of the law is going to affect January 1st, 2014 enrollment in the new competitive health marketplaces where anyone can buy insurance no matter what and can get tax subsidies up afford it will start October 1st. Those are the big pieces. None of the problems that have come up mean we should repeal the law and go back to the old days when you can get thrown off your insurance when you get cancer. Some of the problems need to be fixed. Some of them are made-up problems based on misinformation by opponents. But nothing that has happened suggests that we should go backward forward and not reform the healthcare system. Everything suggests we should move forward, and if there are problems, we should adjust and fix them.
Looking at how things are going here in Wisconsin, we have some of the very first steps of healthcare exchanges, a lot of the healthcare providers making their first filings. That's a ways to go in that process yet. What do you think of about where we are in Wisconsin?
Well, we have it right now. We know what insurance plans are going to be available in the new marketplace. The rates have been held up. We're concerned the Walker administration might try to mislead the public about the rates. But we know that there are going to be 13 plans in the individual market. There are going to be 9 for the small group market. That's small businesses, small employers. That's a lot of competition. Over 92% of Wisconsin residents will have at least 3 choices. So that's a lot more competition. And we think that that's a very good sign that this is going to be a healthy new marketplace where there isn't discrimination, where the major abuses of the insurance industry outlawed, and where people can be in control of their own healthcare decisions and where consumers make the choices rather than insurance companies.
Do you think that all of this will be up and running, the exchanges will be up and running on time for those dates you mentioned?
I do think they will. I think that it was a great sign that that many insurance companies are entering the market. A lot of them are nonprofit options. There's a new health cooperative that's going to cover a lot of states, so people have options that aren't for-profit insurance. It certainly looks like that we're on track to have this up and running. So on October 1st, all of a sudden, people who don't have access to good insurance at work, and that's a lot of people in small businesses, people who are self-employed, people uninsured, are going to be able to go to a website and start shopping for insurance that can never be taken away from them and which is much more affordable for most people.
Never be taken away. This is going to be portable even if I get a job, I'm no longer self-employed, something like that?
Well, yes. What happens under this system is either your employer provides good coverage or you have access to this marketplace. So you're either going to get insurance at work or you're going to be able to go to this marketplace. In addition, it has huge advantages for small businesses. They're going to get a 50% tax credit, and they get to go onto the marketplace and shop for insurance. We're at a point in Wisconsin where only 32% of Wisconsin small businesses can provide health insurance because they can't afford it. It used to be 60% just a decade ago. This changes that dramatically. So, in fact, small businesses will be able to retain employees better because a lot of their employees leave just to get health insurance right now.
There have been critiques that maybe some businesses will stop their health care policies. They don't want to deal with the bureaucracy of the Affordable Care Act is one argument I've seen. Another one is, well, hey, our employees can go on to these options that are out there. Not through us. We're going to save some money by doing that. Is that something you see happening?
Well, it doesn't affect medium and large employers. I mean, they continue to provide coverage as they do today. They can drop coverage today. There's no law that says you have to provide health coverage. The reason they do provide coverage is because it's a competitive advantage. They get better employees and they retain them, and that doesn't change. And so there's nothing in Massachusetts where a similar law was implemented years ago. There's been no such effect. In fact, more employers provide coverage. So I think that is part of the general attempt to scare the public about health reform in a last-ditch effort to try to block it.
And Senator Johnson told us he's worried that the law will lead to a rationing of health care in the United States because of federal mandates, federal control over how the care is provided. What do you say to that?
I mean, there's nothing even close to rationing. That's just another scare tactic. There is a requirement that the plans be high-quality plans. They meet minimum standards. They don't have all sorts of gotyas and holes in them that cause you to fall into medical bankruptcy when you thought you had health insurance when someone in the family gets sick. I don't consider that something that is rationing. That's just basic consumer protection that we should all believe in. And right now we have a situation in Wisconsin where for people who buy insurance on their own, 37% of the plans are below our substandard plans that are full of holes where people think they're covered and then they're not once they need the insurance the most. And so I don't think consumer protection amounts to something unreasonable at all. It's essential in modern society.
Looking at the political future of the Affordable Care Act right now, Senator Johnson yesterday acknowledged that with Harry Reid as the Senate Majority Leader, President Obama in the White House, it's not going away anytime soon. Do you worry about the results of the next elections changing that formula and maybe putting the Affordable Care Act at risk?
I see it quite the opposite. I think that you see this conservative outright push to try to block it now because they're well aware that once people have it, they won't want to give it up. All the opposition to enacting Medicare in 1965 melted away within 6 months once seniors had it and realized that all the scare stories weren't true at all. And so I think that's why there's such a big fight to try to derail this and even shut down the government, because the conservatives know very well it'll be very hard to take this away from people once they have it.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. A pleasure.
That was Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin.
Next, we'll head to Graceland to talk to an Elvis fan about how she's commemorating the anniversary of the king's death. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
Today is the 36th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley, considered by many the king of rock and roll. Here's a taste of the king right now.
Don't be cruel. It's true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said.
Many people will make the pilgrimage to Graceland to mark the occasion, including our next guest, Robin Cherry. But commentator Dean Robbins tells us about a place a little closer to home in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
The Elvis Presley story has religious overtones. A poor boy is endowed with divine talent, then rises from obscurity to become a rock and roll god. I'm a true believer myself. I've even made pilgrimages to the Elvis shrines in the South, his birthplace in Tupelo, and Graceland, his home in Memphis. Many Elvis fans will flock to those sacred sites this year for the 35th anniversary of his death. But Wisconsinites needn't go that far to observe the solemn occasion. We have a sacred site of our own right in Madison, not as well known as Graceland, but authentic nonetheless. At a busy intersection on the east side of town, a small stone marker bears Elvis's image. It stands on the spot where the King of Rock and Roll performed a real miracle in the middle of the night on June 24, 1977. Elvis had just flown into Madison for a concert, and he was still wearing his sparkly jumpsuit. On the way to a hotel, his limousine stopped at the fateful intersection, East Washington Avenue and Highway 51. Elvis looked out the window, and at the corner gas station, he saw two guys beating up a teenager. He flung open the car door. "I can't let this happen," he said, in savior mode. Over the strenuous objections of his bodyguard, he strode toward the attackers. Now remember, this was the summer of 1977. Our hero was overweight and ailing. But he did have a black belt in karate and a not unwarranted confidence in his power to change the course of human affairs. One can only imagine how the villains felt when a sparkling, obese man approached them, throwing karate kicks and shouting, "I'll take you on." One can only imagine their shame when they realized it was Elvis Presley himself who had caught them in an evil act. They stopped in mid-punch, and their victim fled to safety. After such an otherworldly experience, I wouldn't be surprised if the two thugs vowed to reform right on the spot. As awed bystanders watched in wonder, Elvis shook hands all around, jumped back in his limousine, and vanished into the night.
Don't mention my name. Forget where you came.
Police officers and newspaper reporters showed up later to make sense of the visitation. The gas station rescue was the last miracle of Elvis's life. He died less than 2 months later. But Wisconsin still has the corner of East Washington Avenue and Highway 51 to remind us that he once walked among us, performing extraordinary feats. I've stood there more than once, staring at the patch of ground where the gas station used to be. I swear that, even as traffic whizzes by, you can feel Elvis's presence.
I'm safe. I'm safe.
Dean Robbins is the editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative weekly. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This piece was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council.
Our next guest is an Elvis fan who does make the pilgrimage to Graceland every year. Robin Cherry is a producer and director of the Joy Cardine Show here on the Ideas Network, and she's an Elvis super fan. That's an understatement, by the way. She joins us from Graceland. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us from Graceland. So,
enjoying myself, yes.
I bet you are. Do you remember where you were the day that he died and when you received the news of his death at 36 years ago today?
Yes, I was at home. I had gone to summer school that summer, and I was putting together a few odds and ends regarding starting the school year, which is going to start for me that in a few weeks after his death. So I was figuring out, you know, what books I had to get and, you know, notebooks, and I was putting together my list, and my mother came in the kitchen and she said, "Robin, Elvis died." And at first, of course, I didn't believe her, but then we turned on the television and there was a special report. They had cut into programming and he was gone.
Hmm. How did you react to that news?
You know, it felt like losing a loved one. Even though I had never met him, he was someone I'd gotten to know, I had studied. You know, to me, he was a very important part of my life because I loved his music, and I liked his campy movies, and I read quite a few books about him, so I was familiar with his character. And it really was like losing a loved one. I took that kind of hard.
Hmm. So why do you love Elvis so much?
Well, you know, for one reason, I liked Elvis a lot. I liked his humanity. Elvis was a very generous person, and his raw talent. Even at the time of his death, he still had tremendous raw talent. And the fact that, you know, he could sing, he could dance, and he could act despite the campy movies. I just liked his extreme talent. I mean, love Elvis or hate him, his talent is undeniable.
Mm. So I understand you go to Graceland every year. And
yeah.
Do you always go for Elvis Week?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. you know, there really isn't anything like Elvis Week. One of the things that I really love about Elvis Week is meeting other Elvis fans who are at my level. You know, that is such a treat to trade, you know, your favorite Elvis stories, favorite Elvis songs. That is so much fun to talk to people who loved him just as much as I did. It's just so much fun.
So when did you start going?
I started going about 15 years ago to Elvis Week. And, you know, every time I come, there is something different. I was saying this morning that the estate has over, I think it's three warehouses of memorabilia and his possessions. And they've really only scratched the surface with the exhibits. So every time I come, there is something different.
Okay. And have you made any lifelong friends with each journey? Do you keep in touch with these super fans between trips?
No, I don't. I don't keep in touch between trips. But I do see people that I am familiar with. One of the people that works at the dealership where I have my car service is a super fan as well. And I've run into him once or twice here with his wife and daughter. So, yeah, that would be the closest that I would come
mm-hmm.
to that.
So what's your favorite part of Graceland? If you could recommend one thing, what would it be?
It would be the racquetball court. The racquetball court is quite spectacular. It's about 12 feet high, and it covers from floor to ceiling all of his platinum and gold albums, every single award he's ever received, and his favorite jumpsuits are encased. It really is a sight to see. When you walk in, your mouth drops open. It is absolutely beautiful. And the last piano he ever played is also in there. He played Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain that morning, and about an hour later, he passed away. So it's really quite spectacular.
Wow. Were those decorations added? I call them decorations. I shouldn't do that. But were those added after his death, or was he lining the racquetball court with that stuff while he was still around?
No, that was created after his death.
Okay.
When he died, it truly was a racquetball court. And he was going to go into business. It was going to be called Presley Racquetball Court. And, of course, that didn't happen after he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So they totally redesigned it after he died.
Well, what are they doing in Graceland to commemorate the anniversary of his death?
This year, I've noticed it's rather subdued. Because whenever it's an off year, they don't do quite as much. Last year, the 35th was huge. But, you know, this year they had, you know, members of the his entourage came and they gave lectures. The woman who worked at Sun Records with Sam Phillips, his first recording company, she came and gave a lecture yesterday for all the fan club members. Tonight, there's going to be a showing of the Aloha concert. I don't know if you remember that, Elvis from Hawaii. They've remastered that, and that, there's going to be a special showing of that at the Orpheum Theater. And there was a huge gospel concert yesterday morning, which was really nice. So they have a lot of really terrific activities.
Sounds like a lot to do, Robin, and I'm sure you're enjoying every moment of it.
Yes, I am. It's an Elvis Disneyland.
Aw. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Take care now.
You too. That was Robin Cherry, a producer and director for The Joy Cardine Show. She joined us from Graceland.
Coming up, we'll talk about a unique phobia, or at least a creeped-outedness, about clowns. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I took her to a show. I went for some candy. Along came Jim Dandy, and they snuck right out the door. Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you?
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll get a recap of the top state news stories with WPR News Guy.
I'll take it with Noah Obshinsky. But first, there's a cultural icon in the world that brings joy to many and sheer terror to others. We're talking, this will explain that music there, about the clown. Whether you love clowns or you hate them, it's hard to think of anything else that elicits such strong emotions on both sides. But why is that?
Well, we recently saw an article called The
History and Psychology of Clowns Being Scary. We called up the author, Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. She's a freelance journalist. Her article appeared in Smithsonian Magazine Online. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Linda, obviously clowns generate strong emotion. I gotta know, you wrote this piece, you looked at the history of clowns. Are you one of the people who's weirded out by clowns?
To be honest, I am a little bit weirded out by clowns, but it's more because I generally don't find them that funny. Now, that said, I do remember being a very little girl and going to see Red Skelton and thinking, just being enchanted and thinking he was hilarious. So obviously, at some point, I did like clowns. I think generally, though, I find them a little weird.
So you looked into, you aren't weirded out by them. I'm not particularly either. But, and they're there to bring joy and laughter to a lot of people. But so why do they have, from a lot of people's perspective, this dark side?
Well, I think clowns have actually always had a dark side in the sense that there's always been a character who's mischievous, and this is in sort of all pretty much cross-cultural and throughout theatrical traditions, religious traditions all over the world, that there's always this sort of mischievous character, a trickster character. And historically, that character has been both very funny and also a little dangerous, a little edgy. It hasn't really been until the 20th century, however, that once clowns became entertainment solely for children, that kind of edginess was plastered over with white face paint to some degree. And no longer could it be acceptable that they were sort of dark and edgy and we could understand that. They sort of had to become almost solely innocent children's entertainment. And that makes everyone suspicious.
I want to talk, before we get into the modern era, you in your piece wrote about a couple of famous clowns that set the stage for the modern sort of troubled image of a clown, Joseph Grimaldi and Pierrot. I don't know if I'm pronouncing those
yeah,
right.
Yeah, Jean-Gaspard Deburo, and I probably just absolutely butchered that. both of those clowns, they were clowns in a theatrical tradition in the early 19th century. Grimaldi was hugely important to sort of the evolution of modern clowning, but again, he was performing on stage, and he sort of pioneered the whole white face paint with bright spots and weird colored hair and also the sort of physical comedy. He would do these sort of leaps and somersaults and get into fights with himself and things like that. And Jean-Gaspard Devereaux's Pierrot character was more a sort of silent, almost a Charlie Chaplin character, but still had some makeup and was still very funny, and he was mostly popular in Paris. But both of these guys were well known for who they were outside of the makeup, and who they were outside of the makeup was either tragic or sinister, sort of depending on what you were looking at. Grimaldi was an alcoholic. He'd had just terrible things happen to him in his life. His wife died in childbirth. His son died, who was also a clown, died at 31, alcoholic. Devereaux, on the other hand, actually killed someone who insulted him in the street. So, you know, as their respective audiences knew these characters and knew the men playing the characters, there was a sort of sense that not all was right underneath the face paint. And Charles Dickens, in Grimaldi's case, was certainly instrumental in bringing that to the fore. He rewrote, basically, Grimaldi's memoirs after he died and really highlighted the idea that Grimaldi was hurting himself to make other people laugh, that sort of for every laugh he got out of his audience, it was commensurate pain for him.
Well, and you mentioned clowns became children's entertainment, but that dark side, dark image never went away. And then we saw a string of real life and fictional bad clowns. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think what really happened is sort of in the middle of the 20th century, clowns became this children's entertainment, and there were sort of multiple things happening. One, that stranger danger became a bigger fear. Parents became more concerned about the people who were interacting with their children to some degree, or at least much more suspicious. And when you heard about stories like John Wayne Gacy, who was a serial killer, but who was also a clown who performed at hospitals and charities, and who once actually said, you know, clowns can get away with anything. You know, with that in the back of their mind, clowns became more sinister and more worrying. And then you also had all the kids who'd grown up with clowns at this point and maybe perhaps felt there was a bit of a dark side, maybe were sort of suspicious of them, and then once these kinds of ideas about people like John Wayne Gacy started circulating, that kind of culminated in this, in a sort of renaissance of overtly scary, evil clowns like Stephen King's Pennywise, the dancing clown in It, and the scary clown that drags the little boy under the bed, the clown toy that comes to life in Poltergeist and drags the little boy under the bed. So those overtly scary images kind of replace the idea that there was a real person underneath the mask who was sort of tragic and sinister and whatever, with someone who was a murderer, basically, or a demon, or just, you know, absolutely terrifying.
You also looked into what psychologists say about how we develop a fear of clowns. What did you find out?
Well, In a lot of people, it can begin in childhood. There is an entry in the psychologist Bible, the DSM, for a pediatric fear of masked or costume characters, and clowns come under that. It usually starts when children are starting to exhibit separation anxiety, and they're very nervous around things that aren't familiar. And so, you know, clowns with their face paint absolutely come to that. When that continues perhaps through adulthood or manifests in adulthood, people usually give sort of one or two reasons, and it's usually that they're made very uncomfortable by the face paint because they don't know what's happening underneath it. I mean, if you think about it, we read a lot of people's intentions through facial indicators, you know, not just as sort of simple as if they're smiling or if they're frowning, but, you know, subtle things, and the makeup can really conceal that. And then there's the fact that clowns can, as John Wayne Gacy creepily said, get away with anything. They're able to engage in behavior that isn't typically socially allowed, and there are a few consequences. You know, they can squirt water in someone's face or, you know, grab them or touch them inappropriately or things like that. So Those things, the unpredictability, the uncertainty, and the behavior really make people nervous.
And I know we said at the outset, not everybody has clown fear. A lot of people are perfectly fine with clowns. But is it widespread enough that it's hurting the clowning business?
I think there's some differing schools of thought on that. It's actually kind of difficult to get a hold of clowning numbers. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics considers clowns under a sort of larger umbrella category of miscellaneous entertainers. So it's difficult to get real numbers on how many people are clowns. But anecdotally, there are claims that, you know, clowning workshops are on the decline and attendance at clowning conventions are decreasing. That said, people still hire clowns for birthdays. People still go to the circus, and clowns still exist at Ringling Brothers. And there's even evidence that in places like hospitals, therapy clowns are very good for children. There have been studies that have shown that, for example, kids who are admitted to hospital with respiratory infections get better faster after they play with a therapy clown. So I really don't think that clowning is as on decline as you might think, but it's certainly changed in, I think, public perception.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, freelance journalist. Her article, The History and Psychology of Clowns Being Scary, is linked to from our Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, WPR News guy Noah Ovshinsky joins us for a roundup of the week's top stories. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Later in the show, we'll talk to Dr. Sanjay Gupta about his change of heart on medical marijuana.
Now it's our weekly check-in on the big news across the state. Noah Ovshinsky has been bringing us up to date on the headlines this afternoon. Now he joins us to dig deeper into some of the stories in Wisconsin.
Noah, thanks for joining us again this week.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Well, the big news, we heard from Mike Simonson a little bit yesterday, the mining hearing up north. What was going on? What was at stake?
Right. Yesterday was the first of two mandatory public hearings dealing with the proposed iron ore mine in the Pinoki Range. This was sponsored by the DNR, and it was in Hurley yesterday.
And this is one they have to do this, right? The DNR is required to do
exactly.
This under the mining law?
Yeah, there are two mandatory public hearings that are required under the new mining law that passed, a very controversial mining law that recently passed here in Madison. And this particular hearing was focused on Gogebic Taconites, which is the company who wants to build the mine, their plan to do some bulk sampling. They want to take about 4,000 tons of rock from the area and get a sense of, you know, what the rocks look like and you know, that sort of thing.
And a lot of people showed up. What was the turnout like?
Yeah, I believe 150 people attended, or around 150 people attended. And from what I understand, you know, the hearing was quite civil. There really wasn't a lot of name calling. People were very respectful of the speakers and of the DNR officials that were there.
In the midst of a pretty contentious ongoing debate about this thing.
Yes. I mean, we've talked a lot about the mining debate. It's been ongoing, and some of these debates have been quite heated. But yesterday was civil.
And was the testimony kind of focused ahead on what the mine would actually be, or were people raising concerns with the that sampling of 4,000 tons?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
It was sort of a cross-section, really, of concerns. First, it has to be said that, by and large, the hearing, you know, the vast majority of the people who spoke were against the mine, some of whom are against the mine in principle. They don't like mining. There are other folks who spoke yesterday who are concerned about the impact the operations will have on the surrounding area. Obviously, you know, building roads and things like that has an impact on the environment. People are concerned about that. People are also concerned about, you know, potential airborne pollution that might come about as a result of this mining. There's some talk that area may have some sort of asbestos-like fibers that may or may not be released in the mining process. So really a cross-section of concern there.
And supporters, some did show up?
There were a few, and they were largely folks who talked about it in jobs, they said, you know, this mining is about jobs, and you know, they noted that, you know, families are breaking up because there just aren't enough jobs in northern Wisconsin, and that the area needs this kind of industry.
Is there any thought that this bulk sampling isn't going to happen?
No, the bulk sampling, I mean, the DNR is going to make a decision about that maybe in the next 2 months or so. And I think everybody expects the DNR to grant them the ability to be able to mine this, you know, 4,000 tons or so. They expect that to happen. If they do, then GTAC, the mining company, could be mining for rock as early as October.
For the sampling.
For the sampling, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then there's been talk all along that ultimately, if this thing passes the state, and it probably will, we're going to see some kind of plea for intervention at the federal level.
Right. Mike Wiggins, who is a tribal official up in northern Wisconsin, basically was on the record this week as saying that he feels that the EPA may get involved and or the Army Corps of Engineers may get involved, both of which will have to do their own investigations anyway into this mining proposed mining operation. And I think the tribes as well as other mining opponents are depending on the federal government to end this proposal.
And that will be a whole next chapter of this ongoing controversy.
Yeah, I mean, and as far as the federal side of things, this could go on for a few more years.
All right. Well, let's turn to some of the bigger news from the state legislature, schools and voucher schools. What's going on there?
Right. Well, the leaders of the main education committees in the state legislature unveiled really a plan that they've said has been, you know, a few years in the making. And it's essentially a new accountability plan for all schools here in Wisconsin, traditional public schools, charter schools, voucher schools, and that sort of thing.
And the thing that seems to be drawing a lot of attention is that this is putting standards on the voucher and charter schools that people say haven't been there.
Right. Because so right now, and again, we have to maybe rewind just a few months. You know, lawmakers just passed a pretty substantial expansion of the voucher program here in the state. And one of the criticisms that people have had is, well, we're expanding this program, yet there's no accountability, no transparency with these schools that are going to be using taxpayer money. And so, you know, this plan partially addresses this. This accountability plan does include voucher schools, and it'll be the first time that they will be part of a rating system based on student performance.
And what are what's the measurement, and then what's the stick if they don't shape up?
So they broadly they look at student performance. The stick is several things. You know, voucher schools under this plan that rank at the bottom of performance for 3 years would no longer be allowed to take new voucher students. That's significant. Charter schools could close if they rank poorly. So there are definitely a few sticks that are included in this.
And what's been the reaction from voucher advocates?
Right. Well, one would think, oh, you know, this, you know, voucher schools are expanding in the state. You know, maybe they'd have something to say about it, and they have. And by and large, the pro-voucher lobby here in the state doesn't support the legislation as it currently is written because they think it gives too much power to the Department of Public Instruction, who, of course, is led by the superintendent. And the lobbyists argue that, you know, DPI has generally been against vouchers. And so they think they shouldn't be in a place or in a position to gauge the performance of these voucher schools.
And if the voucher advocates are unhappy about it, are, say, the teachers' unions, advocates for public schools, happy?
Yeah, no, they're not. And in addition to being generally against voucher schools anyway, they don't like this legislation because it doesn't require voucher schools to be subject to, you know, open records and open meetings law like traditional public school districts are. And also, as far as the unions are concerned, they also don't like the fact that this legislation doesn't even require educators, you know, and teachers to be licensed.
But that's just the status quo now, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So no change there, but they'd like to see it go further.
Exactly.
Am I hearing that right?
Right.
Okay.
They would like traditional public schools and voucher schools to be on the, you know, even playing field.
What's the next step for this legislation?
I believe the bill sponsors are planning to hold a public hearing on the bill in September.
All right. Now, some national news here and how it's shaping up in Wisconsin. Immigration reform at the national level. What's going on here in the state to react to what's going on there?
Right. Well, a few things. One is Congress will be returning from their summer recess here very shortly. And one of the things that they're set to do is deal with this immigration issue. As you might know, the Senate passed immigration reform, essentially, and it's been sort of sitting idle in the House. And people expect there to be some action on immigration potentially in the next few months. The other thing that happened this week is that this week was the one-year anniversary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which is kind of a mouthful. But it was unveiled by the Obama administration last year. And essentially what it did was it allowed undocumented people brought into the U.S. when they were young or when they were kids. It allows them to register and stay here without fear of deportation. And this was was the anniversary.
And here in Wisconsin, advocates for immigration reform are making a push, it looks like. What's going on?
Yeah, the Wisconsin Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, they launched a statewide tour this week in an effort to push for immigration reform. In Wausau, actually, earlier this week, there was a group of business, religious, and law enforcement leaders who came together to push for immigration reform. It was called officially the Bibles, Badges, and Business for Immigration Reform. That was the name of the program.
And what's the case on the business side? That's interesting that they're getting involved there.
Right. You know, for many businesses, it's an issue of protecting their workforce and, I suppose, ultimately protecting their profits. One of the speakers in Wausau was Ed Lump, who's the CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. And you know, he basically said, look, you know, we employ a lot of immigrants in the industry, and it is in our best interest to make sure that immigration reform moves forward.
We'll be watching that at the national level here on Central Time, definitely, and maybe check out what's going on in the state as well. Now, Senator Tammy Baldwin, made some news this week on research, medical and scientific research.
Yeah. Senator Baldwin met with medical researchers this week at UW-Milwaukee and UW-Madison. And basically, it was an excuse for her, really, to talk about this new legislation that she says she's going to introduce here in this session. And it's intended to help young scientists. For instance, it's going to, you know, improve mentorship between, you know, veteran and new researchers. She's quick to note that this is not a funding bill. This is just a policy bill that will make sure that we have a new crop of young scientists coming in and you know, making breakthroughs in the field.
But she's trying to draw attention to this issue at a time when the federal government sequester is, well, cutting money to lots of things, including scientific research, scientific funding.
Right. You know, I think her visit here to Wisconsin and talking about her legislation, it basically raises the question, you know, what role does government-funded research have in this era of budget tightening? And what effect is it having on the future pool of researchers? And right now, as far as research is concerned, you know, the National Institutes for Health is the federal agency that gives universities like UW-Madison quite a bit of money to do medical research. And right now, that funding is the lowest it's been. Some scientists have said it's been the lowest they've ever seen, really, and that it's really complicating things, not only because it's inhibiting their ability to do research, but it's also showing, you know, young scientists, young students coming into the business, basically saying, you know, this research isn't valued, and, you know, some of these potential researchers are maybe picking other jobs or picking other career paths because the money isn't there for the kind of research that they want to do.
Are researchers, you said Senator Baldwin was here talking to researchers in Milwaukee and Madison. What's their take on this? They're worried, I imagine?
Absolutely. They are absolutely worried, not only because of their own projects that they're working on, but of course, what this means for their students. You know, they're concerned that, you know, they have generally been, some of them have been really, you know, really well funded in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they get defunded or if they have less money to do their work, these professors and researchers are worried that people are just going to pick a different job. They're going to pick a different career path.
Noah, thanks a lot for joining us again this week.
Thanks, Rob. It was my pleasure.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's Assistant News Director.
Coming up after the news, we want to hear from you about home. Yesterday, we talked about the meaning of home, and we want to continue that today. What does it mean to you? Do you think it's important to own a house? Are you about to ship your kids off to college? Did someone in your family just go into assisted living? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.